Hey, this is Dan from Karate Cafe, and you are listening to the Practical Defense Podcast with Alex Haddix. Can you smell that? That's another batch of practical defense. Defense.
Welcome to the Practical Defense Podcast, where you'll learn practical approaches to staying safe in our increasingly dangerous urban environments. I'm your host, Alex Haddix, and this is episode 211, Women's Defense Issues with Gila Hayes. This week we have another fantastic guest, author, self-defense instructor, former law enforcement officer, and director of the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, Gila Hayes, stops in to discuss women's defense and training issues. This is a particularly important episode for our younger female listeners. We discuss confidence and awareness lifestyle, protection in the workplace, women-specific training, and defensive tools. Also, here at the top of the show, I'd like to mention that we are bringing back Doc Wesson for a third show. His explanation of Kevlar vests generated a huge discussion on the forums and in personal messages, so we're going to have him back for a question and answer session. If you have any questions that weren't answered on the shows or need a point clarified, send it to us by email or leave us a question on the tip line. The email address is podcast@alexhaddix.com and the comment line is 805-203-6586. The deadline for consideration is March 30th. Alrighty, we'll be right back with Gila Hayes and our discussion of women's defense issues.
The legal aftermath of using a gun in self-defense can be traumatic and expensive. Get help and peace of mind through the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. Network members receive much-needed financial and legal support right after a self-defense incident. They also receive education in the form of DVDs from some of the top names in the business, along with having access to a nationwide pool of attorneys. Learn about membership at www.armedcitizensnetwork.org.
Welcome back. Now this week, our guest is Gila Hayes, who actually plays dual roles. One, she's a senior member and instructor at the Firearms Academy of Seattle, and then she also is heavily involved in the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, runs the back office for that, and writes the journal. So thanks for coming on, Gila.
Well, thanks for having me, Alex. I'm looking forward to talking with you about a subject that I've lived and had a lot of passion for many years now.
Well, that's why we're having you on, because you are one of the top people in the industry for women's defense. So what we're going to talk about today is women's topics in terms of self-defense as a whole. You are a firearms person, but what we're going to try and do is we're going to try and keep it a little more general and not so firearms focused.
Well, Alex, I think that that's real appropriate because those who have gone far in their education and understanding of the use of the firearm and its role in self-defense well understand that it plays a limited, albeit very critical role that applies to only a very small spectrum of the self-defense concerns that we face.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I really see, and I teach firearms as one tool in the toolbox, and there are plenty of options out there, and firearms are one of them, and people need to be aware of that, but it is not the only solution. It is not the ultimate solution.
It just doesn't do everything that you need, particularly at those lower levels.
So let's talk about the unique challenges that women face in that right out of the gate, they're seen as targets. How can women reduce that vulnerability or reduce that perception that they're targets?
Well, Alex, I think that we're going against millennia of how organized societies have seen women. And, you know, that's the unfortunate truth that we're starting with. And if you read the literature, say, for example, studies of rape during wartime and those kinds of things, and while that's not limited to females, the fact is it seems to hit that part of the population harder, and so that it is a hard thing that women deal with, you know, pretty much from earliest awareness. Having said that, I see both genders choosing to ignore avoidable risk and failing to prepare for hazards against which they might need to defend themselves. And so avoidance isn't necessarily limited to the ladies, and acknowledgement of danger is for everything. Having said that, I do think, and at my age of 50 some years, I think I've lived this enough to be firmly convinced that the prevalence of times and places where women need to be prepared to avoid threats or be ready to counter at a minimum that, you know, interview approach where somebody's checking out whether you're going to be a easy target or not, I think that women do face that more frequently than men. And I think that women, particularly aware, alert women, do spend more time and energy being aware of their safety concerns. And I think for us ladies, it does take a little more time and thought so that what I'd call the now what moment doesn't turn into a problem. For example, I take a class every Wednesday night from 6 to 9, and that's my free time, and I love it dearly. But I always give myself extra time going there so that I can get a parking place that's close to the building entrance and that's a safe parking place. And, you know, so far so good. But last Wednesday, I pulled into the general area, and unbeknown to me, the building and across the street from the class building had the entire block had burned down, and so that street was completely closed off. So I had a now what moment. I'm used to parking in this safe place. It's shut off. Now what do I do? And so, of course, I find parking about a block away, and I'm aware that much later that evening, I'm going to need to go from the classroom building to this more distance parking area. But it's fine because I've layered my preparations. And so I give you an example and say, self-defense preparation is kind of like an onion. Just one layer doesn't work by itself. So if my main layer there had been parking in a safe place, then I needed additional layers. I had, because I'm in a state where it's legal and I do practice this, a concealed handgun on my person. And maybe more importantly, I had supporting equipment. I had a good flashlight, you know, which is appropriate for work at night, though it's not as applicable to an immediate self-defense situation. I had a cell phone and all of those other things with which we buffer ourselves. So if that what if moment comes, or what now moment, whether that's losing your safe parking place or whether that's having your car break down unexpectedly in a remote or a bad part of town, that you've got these other layers in place so that you can still remain as safe as possible under the circumstances.
Now, I almost hate to ask this. Did you ask somebody to escort you?
I have a friend that I attend that class with, and she and I have been for years now walking each other to their cars, and nobody leaves until the other one is safely, has the engine started and go.
Excellent. So that helped out that night as well, then.
It's just another one of those layers, Alex, is what it is. And so the point being, and it kind of goes to what we said a few minutes earlier, that the gun isn't the whole thing either. You've got these different layers of preparation so that if one is peeled away, there's something else there.
Okay.
You know, and it may sound, spelling that out for you, it's like, wow, that's extreme. This woman's, you know, carrying a gun, and this woman's always got a flashlight, and this woman's, you know, careful where she parks. It may sound like a lot of work, but I think what I'd say is, having lived this way for many years, it's just a habit. It's just a habitual preparation, a habitual thinking things out before I'm immersed in them so that I can look out for my well-being. And the reason that's important to me is not because I spend all of my time worrying that the boogeyman's going to get me. If anything, it's just the opposite. By having learned to live in that somewhat perhaps more thoughtful fashion, I'm free to do a lot of things that are really important to me. You know, whether it's that evening class, or whether it's riding motorcycles, or, you know, things that people might say, oh, you're exposed in that situation. Don't you worry when you pull into a rest area. Worry might be the wrong word, but you're prepared for what may come your way.
Denying that the boogeyman exists doesn't mean that he doesn't. And that's no protection from that. So, I mean, everyone needs to take steps to protect themselves. And it doesn't take a whole lot, but like you're saying, it just takes a little bit. And once it's ingrained into the way that you conduct yourself, I'm not going to use the word routine, because routine says there are patterns and patterns are bad.
but into your daily activities and how you conduct and comport yourself will add a significant level of safety with no guarantees, but add a significant level of safety that it doesn't have to inhibit or restrict your lifestyle.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that we're not looking at building a lifestyle or habits that indicate that we're fearful and that we're always looking over our shoulder. I think that our goal is confidence, self-reliance, independence, freedom to do the things that are important to us. And I think we balance the risks inherent in life, in a full life. There's risks that are inherent in living. There's risks that are inherent in getting up every morning. But we balance those by our thoughtfulness, by our awareness, by our preparation. And those thought patterns that keep us from wandering blindly into something where we are blindsided or such an attractive victim that even a criminal who wasn't thinking about doing something just couldn't resist, that I think that we balance those two aspects of life, the freedom and the independence and the ability to do the things we love. We balance those by our preparations to respond if something bad happens. Now, having said that, I think that people, and perhaps women in particular, need to make an individual commitment, and that, say in my case, I make a commitment to myself and to my own safety, and part of that means not letting people talk me into things that entail being places or doing things where the risk isn't something that I can mitigate, and that may be the bar scene, for example, or that may be for younger people, certain parties or social events that is pretty predictable that there's going to be violence or aggression as part of it, and so you do have to make smart decisions. And I'm certainly not saying that by being prepared you can go anywhere and do anything. That there's a middle road for all of this.
Absolutely. Let's shift a bit and talk about problems that may be unique to women in the workplace in terms of unwanted advances, sexual harassment, things of that nature.
Alex, I think the important thing about workplace issues is rarely do they start with the incident that's intolerable. They've generally started with low-level talk or chatter, inappropriate conversation, things that made you uncomfortable, but you were not willing to ruffle feathers enough to say, stop that. I don't want to have that kind of talk with you. Don't come into my work cubicle unless you have business to do with me, those kinds of things. And women tend very much to be a collaborative. And so we've been trained from earliest childhood to get along. And that training steps up and betrays us when someone has decided to see whether we're passive, whether we're submissive, whether we'll be a good victim for them. And so the thing that's important about the workplace situation is to recognize those early advances. And some people call it an interview process. And I think that's entirely appropriate, where someone will begin inappropriate conversation, say things to see how you react when they make you uncomfortable, get too close into your personal space to see if you'll push back. And I think that the sooner you can put those appropriate barriers up to look out for yourself, the better it is. And I think where it gets really difficult is if someone has been being tested, because it's testing to see how good of a victim you're going to be, how easy it's going to be to take you down whatever path the victimizer wants to. But if that's been going on for a while and you've not either recognized it for what it was or been afraid to put a stop to it, then it gets really hard because you've been letting some of this go on. Now, how do you put a stop to it? And I think you've just got to be very direct and say, I don't want to be part of this. Don't approach me that way anymore. Only come to me unless you have, work-related things that we need to go through. And it may be appropriate to make sure that you don't have to have alone time with that person. Obviously, there's the whole structure in place for reporting to supervisors. Sometimes that works. Many times it doesn't, because the supervisor's focus is on the bottom line and you're just being a problem to them. And anybody who's worked in a situation where you didn't have a command structure that was sympathetic to what you needed knows the look that comes over the supervisor's face when you raise a question that they don't want to have to deal with. You may very well get that. And that's why, just like all of the self-defense stuff, the burden's going to ultimately come back on you. And I think you have to be very direct and let that person know that you don't choose to be any part of this kind of banter, this kind of activity that they're attempting to impose on you. Now, sometimes, of course, it's much more forceful than that. And I think that it's absolutely critical that people, not just women in general, that people have elementary self-defense skills as far as getting out of grabs. For example, somebody grabs your wrist, how do you get away? That people think about the way that they're dressed even. Is it the kind of clothing that you can move freely in so that you can make that escape if it's, you know, a much higher level threat against you?
But that's got to be incredibly hard because, you know, if you have to work with this person on a daily basis, then you risk offending them.
Well, you know, at that point, maybe this is my age talking, but you know what? I'm the one who's offended. See, Alex, I think that we've missed this whole self-defense thing by being trained to be so darned nice. I'm editing my language here, but we, and particularly women, again, as I said, we've been taught to be the peacemaker. We've been taught to be the cooperative, part of the equation. And so what we've got is a whole gender of people who are ripe for victimization because that's been their enculturation. And let's turn that around. This person is behaving in an offensive manner to me. Why am I worried about him being offended? Heck, I'm the one who's offended. Do you get the sense of what I think we need to be coming out of here, reacting out of? Not that, oh my goodness, he'll be offended if I say, don't talk to me that way, George, when really I'm the one who should be up in arms here. What business do you have talking to me in a sexually explicit fashion? What business do you have suggesting that I would participate in something like that with you? Do you see what I'm putting out as an example?
Absolutely.
I think it's critical. And I think if we came to the heart of the self-defense onion, what we would find in the really successful examples is a very healthy self-esteem, if you will, or self-regard. And you'll see this when people come. I've seen it in my students that people will come and they'll say, the reason I'm here to learn how to shoot is I'm a single mom and I'm responsible for my three kids. And you know what? That's really admirable. I'm glad that mothers feel responsible for their children's well-being. But wouldn't it make as much sense if each of us, whether we have children or not, had that same regard, had that same concern for the equally valuable spark of life and humanity and spirit and soul that we are? Aren't we just as important? And so I think that's what's missing back to your workplace scenario. And I think maybe it's just a microcosm that lets us talk about bigger issues. The reason we get into trouble when people make those initial interviews or those continued interviews, you know, before it goes into touching or that type of thing, they nearly always try to figure out if you're going to let it happen, is because we don't have that high self-regard. We put ourselves as kind of second-class citizens, and we're afraid of offending the offender, and that's just backwards.
So one of the key messages here is don't lose sight of actually who the victim is.
That's a good way to put it.
Remember that you're the person that's being victimized, and by speaking up for yourself, it's not making him the victim.
Oh, not at all. You didn't start this. Well, I mean, I hope you didn't start this. If you had fallen into patterns of behavior that your communication style is flirty or perhaps you use sexually explicit language or things like that to get things started, then think about that now and think about that it may cause situations that you don't want to have to deal with later on. And this won't be popular, but I tell people this even about their clothing styles and, you know, the shoes and the revealing clothing and those types of things, that, yes, we're in a society where that's very fashionable. But the thing that we've got to realize is it brings attention on you. Sometimes getting attention from everybody is not the most desirable outcome, and you will get the attention from the psychos as much or more often than you'll get the attention from the people who you would like to be associating with. And so you've got to make some decisions about how you're going to attract the people you want to associate with. And there's certainly ways that are going to bring you more trouble than they're worth. There's one final thought, and this will be unpopular, but I guess I'm used to being the prophet of unpopular thoughts. There may be situations in the workplace, if your command structure is not responsive to the problems that you're having, where it may be in your best interest to leave that situation. And I know that the job market's tough and people are holding on to work, you know, as if their lives depended on it. But there may be a time to walk away from a situation that is just too dangerous to mitigate. And certainly if we're looking for jobs, we need to weigh safety and how people behave in that workplace towards one another as to whether it's a safe place for us to even go into. But if you're in a position where you just cannot mitigate the danger to yourself, and you're not getting support and help from, you know, the supervisory structure for someone who is harassing you, or if the harasser is in the supervisory structure, you may need to leave that situation for your own well-being. And I know that that's hard and it may seem impossible, but sometimes things just can't be solved where they're at.
Absolutely. I've spent a number of years at different companies and as a contractor, and I jump around departments a lot. You know, whatever the project is, I switch projects. Even within the same company, different departments can have a completely different feel and different structure and different methods of working. Mm-hmm. I've worked in project development, software development, IT, and education. And even within education departments or IT departments, things are very, very different. You know, in some cases, it's very strict, hardline corporate. And then in other departments within the same company, people, you know, wear sandals and they actually curse, which, you know, when that first walked into one department, the people were actually cursing out loud. I was like, whoa, that's, you know, that's not all corporate stuff. But in this particular environment, it's accepted, which I found really, really shocking.
You hear the word corporate culture, but I think you hit it on the head. It's probably more correctly stated as departmental culture.
You just ask for a transfer or try and shift departments instead of leaving the company. But if it's bad, absolutely leave, because it depends upon the size of the company. The person can follow you and still can maintain contact with you that you're trying to avoid.
Yeah, that is good advice. And many companies even have various locations that perhaps you could be shifted to. So that's a real good bit of advice you've inserted in there, Alex. I'm glad you said that.
Cool. Thank you. So let's shift now over to training best practices for women. And I know that you've got a lot of experience in this, and you've spent years teaching women, and you have some opinions on this.
Oh, I do, Alex, because it's, you know, until we started the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, that was what I was doing, you know, full time for some 15 or 20 years. You know, I've taught in both many co-ed situations, and I've also taught some women's only programs. But it's, I think that as every instructor knows, while we've got some information and some knowledge that we strive to share with students, we also learn as much from the students as the students learn from us. It's always a two-way street. But as far as self-defense, I think that probably the hardest thing and the thing that we do the poorest job of is the mindset aspect, because that's almost the job of a psychologist and not a skills instructor. And I know for myself, that was always one of my hardest challenges, because while I had the skill sets down cold, the psychological aspect was not really something that that I was qualified, nor that I should be dealing with them on a one-on-one basis. But what I always did was to try to model or to try to draw out four examples, even as we did at the beginning of this program, about how you can change the way you live and how you can make safety consciousness a habit, and to challenge people to look at their regard for themselves and why sometimes it was so low to where they were taking unnecessary risks just to make their friends and associates happy or comfortable. And so training covers such a broad spectrum of how our students, of the things our students need to learn, that while many of us work in the imparting of the skill sets, we must never lose sight of the fact that those skill sets aren't a lot of use until the person's heart and head catches up with the concepts.
How do you assist in making that transition?
Well, I think that's the toughest thing, but I think that the best thing that any of us can do is to lead by example. And while you don't have that kind of contact steadily with your students, because we are such a diverse society anymore, we aren't in little cultural groups where the leaders are the older people who've been down the paths before. People come to us that we'll see for 8 hours and then unfortunately maybe never see again, or not see for a couple of months until we see them for another 8 hours, that type of thing. And so I think that what we do is we open up our lives and we tell them how we've learned to live with the risks and how we've learned to mitigate the dangers that come to us. We've shown them that we lead full and happy lives, and that we form relationships and have friends and do exciting and fun things without taking unreasonable risks to ourselves, without perhaps dressing or behaving ourselves in ways that bring undue or unwanted attention on ourselves from predators, you know, those kinds of things. And at that point, I think that what we hope is our students see standing in front of them a skilled person who's living a full life, who's not giving up a lot of the things that the student wishes for herself, but is doing so in a little safer manner, in a way that's not as likely to cause them to fall victim to a predator. And I think that's the best we can do. Having said that, one of the topics I thought that we might discuss today would be the issue of whether women's only training is, sometimes people ask, is the best place for my wife to start in a women's only class? And I'm kind of mixed emotion on that. I think that it's useful if there's women in the instructor cadre where you're going to be training, because you may have woman-specific questions, whether you're training in hand-to-hand skills, whether you're training in handguns, just whatever course you're pursuing. I don't know that I think women's only training is the be-all, end-all, because it generally functions best at the beginning or introductory level where the female student is so unsure of herself that she's not going to go to a co-ed class and deal with feeling like her inadequacies are so great that she, and I've heard this, I've heard this phrase and it always makes me feel so bad, doesn't even deserve to be there. And you know, I think that, again, we'd almost have to look back to the self-worth psychology that we all deserve to live. We all deserve to have the skills that it takes to survive in this rather challenging world that we found ourselves in. One of the impediments to women taking co-ed classes is sometimes we've failed to do our basic fundamental training, and we find ourselves in classes that we really are attempting to learn skill sets that we haven't laid the foundations for. So what I would say if a woman was looking at getting self-defense skills is don't fail to begin at the beginning, whether that means an introduction to handguns class or a fundamentals of women's safety class. Start at the bottom and learn those fundamental skills really well, master them. And then as you move forward, you are going to eventually find it in your best interest to take part in co-ed classes, if for no other reason than most of the threat to women come from male predators. And so you can't just operate in isolation in training and expect it to work on the street. But it may be helpful to lay that foundational work where you're most comfortable and get those fundamental skills worked out really well. And then when you go into the co-ed class, you have a little more self-confidence. And goodness knows, I've taught classes where the ladies who had done that, who were really solid in their fundamental skills, did better than some of the gentlemen. And that was hard for some of the fellows, but it simply indicated that the ladies had learned their fundamental lessons a little bit better, and they came a little bit better prepared. So that would be my short bit of advice on training.
Okay. From my experience with empty-handed techniques, and this is one of the things that I teach with the Jim Wagner course, is because women can be so self-conscious and feel like they're always on stage when men are around, that I've had women come to some of my courses only because I'm the only man there. The husbands, boyfriends aren't even allowed to even watch because the girlfriend, wife, or sometimes grandmother or father are there for the one person, but the other 5-10 women in the room, it makes them uncomfortable. So we actually kick all the men out. And even the assistants that I use are women for the courses.
Well, I can certainly see that. And I think that what you're getting to is, again, that core psychology, and I would call it the demon of self-consciousness. And it is. It's a huge impediment to learning and skill development. Where did women start identifying themselves through the eyes of other people? Because that's what you're dealing with, isn't it? She's identifying herself through the husband's eyes. We've got to learn to respect and value ourselves to where we're doing it for us. Because, you know, I'll tell you from personal experience in other fields, if you're learning it for somebody else, it never quite takes.
The feedback that I get is that they don't want to look stupid. They don't want to be put in compromising positions. They don't want to look inferior or incompetent. And it really has to do to the basics with self-confidence issues. I mean, everyone starts and learns. No one is born knowing how to do it. But I think with the cultural environment is that, you know, women always have to be a certain way. And
well, and what was that great quote about, I believe it was Ginger Rogers and Fred Astaire, that Ginger had to dance as well as he did, only she had to be able to do it in 4-inch high heels and dancing backwards?
Yeah, exactly, yes.
I mean, I think that encapsulates it. But I'll tell you what, I think the solution goes back to something I said a little earlier, and that is, don't be afraid to begin at the beginning. Give yourself permission to do a beginner's class, to be a beginner, because you're right. What you said a minute ago, we didn't learn these things in the womb. They've got to be taught to us, whatever our self-defense method is. And we do ourselves a great disservice if we don't give ourselves the time to be a beginner. And maybe that means that I get to take that beginner class 3 times until I really got it. So be it. I'll be there 3 times.
So in terms of best practices, can you give us a summary?
Sure, Alex. And I think that what it really comes down to, and this will probably be the 3rd time that I've said it, so I think that's important, don't be afraid to be a beginner. And Alex hit it on the head a few minutes ago when he said we have to be taught these things. We didn't, you know, come from the womb knowing these things. And so don't be afraid to be a beginning student. Nobody expects you to possess skills that no one ever taught you. You need to be willing to go in, and if that means taking the class twice to master those fundamental skills, take the class twice, take the class 3 times, however long it takes to really own the fundamental basic skills of the self-defense method that you're studying. Because as we all know, without the fundamentals, going into the intermediate levels or the advanced stages never really works. And so give yourself the permission to be the beginner. Learn to enjoy being the beginner. Be there because you love the learning, not because somebody told you to be there or told you that you had to be there. Be there because it means something to you to learn ways to take care of yourself and your family, and because you love the process of expanding your abilities. I think that would be the success formula that I would offer.
Okay, great. So let's close by talking about tools. Tools are always fun. People always, you know, like toys.
They say that that's what separates man from the animals is because we use tools. I don't think that that's entirely provable, but yeah, we love our gadgets.
Oh, yeah. I think there's at times an over-reliance on tools, but for women, I don't necessarily think that's the case because so often there is such a significant disparity of physical force and size and weight that women need tools. It's imperative. So from your experiences, the feedback you've gotten, what are some of the tools that you like to teach and recommend to women?
Well, I think you hit it on the head that the tools are a small but important percentage of our overall self-defense equation. So once we've got the mindset and what goes on in our heart and soul worked out, it does make sense to shore up our abilities, you know, with equipment. And some of that is real simple, always having a means of communication, having a flashlight, and they come very small anymore, so this is no longer impossible as it was some 20 years ago. Having a source of light so that if you're in a natural disaster and the lights go out in a big multi-story building, you can extract yourself from that. Where it's legal, and I know that your podcast is heard in a number of areas in the nation where this may or may not be true, where it's legal, as you well know, I'm a proponent of citizens being armed with firearms for their defense, not because it's something that you would use in the vast majority of situations, anything but that. But I do think that there is, at that highest level of threat, at that highest level of danger, and particularly as you referenced for women with the smaller body mass and generally less upper body strength, that the firearm does play a role in A, preventing further assault or stopping ongoing assault, that it's going to be hard to match with anything else. Now, having said that, I think that, and I'll address my part of the industry here. I think that the people producing guns and to some degree even the people doing pepper spray and other tools have probably gone a little bit too far in attempting to make their part of the equipment women specific. And I, for one, would be absolutely happy if I never saw another gun in pink colors or another canister of pepper spray in that putrid pink that everything has to be anymore. That's kind of a hot button for me, and you'll probably be happier if I don't go down that road too much.
I had a feeling you were going to go there. You don't like the leopard prints or the zebra stripes? Or?
You know what it is, Alex, and I think this is what bothers me. I may be completely wrong on this. I feel like it minimizes the importance of what that tool is and should be to the woman who may need to use it in a very serious set of circumstances. And that's my issue with it, that I think that there's been a marketing attempt that says, oh, if I make it pink, or as you said, leopard spots or whatever, it will be attractive to this woman. And to me, that reads, oh, she's not smart enough to understand that she needs to develop these very serious skills to take care of herself. So she had to be attracted because it was colored magenta. That's just hard for me to get around. But then I'm kind of a serious old woman, and what can I do? So having said that, now that I've had my pink tirade, and I believe that I wrote a pretty expansive tirade about that in my Gun Digest piece a couple of years ago, so you can reference that if you want more of the tirade. Having said that, there are some women-specific issues where firearms involved, and the main one is going to be in hand size. That's pretty much simple scientific study that will show that the average woman's hand is generally about a full, length of the tip of your finger shorter than the man's. And while that's certainly, individuals will have different hand sizes, that seems to be the norm. So then we have guns that were made by a company trying to figure out who most of their users were going to be, and certainly I'm sympathetic to that, how business has to run. But the lady picks up the large Beretta pistol, for example, and when it properly centered in the web of the between the thumb and the forefinger, the trigger finger can only barely reach by the merest tip, the edge of the trigger, let alone get that first distal crease on the face of the trigger, which is what you need for, you know, for a smooth, straight pullback on the trigger. So gun size really does make a huge difference. Short answer to that would be if the woman has very small hands and a gun is the way that you want to go, as the car arms pistols, for example, are very small. More and more of the major manufacturers, Smith & Wesson, Glock, Beretta, and I'm sure I'm leaving quite a number out, Heckler & Koch, have all gone to the adjustable size backstrap that is making something of a difference for those of moderate to smaller hands. The very small hands are still going to have issues with some of those mainstream pistols because they are just so large to the hand size. You'll see the same thing in place with shotguns and rifles where you've got a stock that has to be fit to the shoulder. And fortunately, again, there are shorter replacement stocks that can be put on a shotgun, for example. And to some degree, we've got the SWAT industry with the heavy vests and, you know, all of the bulky armor to thank for having to shorten that stock. And for rifles, you'll find the adjustable stocks that make a huge difference. And so the woman will need to work a little bit harder to find equipment that fits, but much more today than, say, 20 years ago, that kind of adjustability is far more accessible. So it's doable. It's doable.
Yeah, because I know a lot of women were forced to go down to use youth stocks on their rifles.
Oh, and nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that. Like I said, fortunately, once we started armoring our SWAT cops up so heavily and sending them into situations, we began to get things like Hoag makes a very short 12.5 or 12-inch shotgun stock that if you want a 12-gauge, it'll go on a 12-gauge. I've got no issue with using a 20-gauge if that's, and that will many times get you into the youth size stocks. But there are options now, and I think the message there is don't struggle with a man-sized gun if you're a woman of usual, you know, smaller, shorter stature, smaller body mass, smaller hands. There are equipment options out there for you that it's worth your time to look up. Now, there may be some resources that might help you locate that. A couple of books, and I'll toot my own horn here, Alex, if that's okay by you.
Absolutely.
My book, Personal Defense for Women, is still sold at GunDigestStore.com, and I do, you know, a fair bit of discussion there of gun fit. I also go into holsters and those kinds of things that are lady-specific, and so that's certainly available. Another place that I would send you for a resource would be Kathy Jackson's Cornered Cat website, which is very extensive, and her book of the same title. So there's two good, strong resources that may very well help with the equipment and other issues that we've talked about today. There's another book that's not female-focused but has done as good a job on the understanding criminality and what the attacker's likely to come at you with, very realistic, which I value deeply. And that's Rory Miller's book, Meditations on Violence. It's probably not something that the beginner's going to find very comforting, but once you've gone down the path a little bit and you're ready to take an unvarnished look at what you may be up against out there, I can't say enough about that book, Meditations on Violence by Rory Miller. Get it and read it.
Actually, I'm going to have to pick that up. I'm not familiar with that one.
Oh my, you should. And I'll be interested to hear from you what you think about it. But I know that a couple of years ago, I did an entire days program for women's self-defense that I brought a lot of issues out of that very work and used it to challenge people to think about where their risk areas were and what it was really realistic that how a guy was going to approach you with the mind of making you his victim. And that would go across the whole spectrum of the things that we were talking about today, the women as targets, the workplace violence issues, all of those things.
All right, Gilly. Well, thanks very much for coming on the show. You've brought up some amazing points that are really specific to women, which I think is very, very important. My show actually has, compared to most podcasts, a large number of listeners that are women. last couple of surveys that we did, you know, 10 to 15% of the listeners are women for the show, and the average for podcasts is less than 5. So we've got a good solid audience, and I think you've helped a lot of people.
Well, I congratulate you on making your information accessible and, you know, not so macho and chest beating that you do put good information out there that the ladies can use. And so it's been a real privilege to talk to your audience and to your folks. And I hope that there's been some ideas that may give us all reason to look at how we're living and see if we can just live a little bit more safely. Because here is my bigger picture idea. The more women who are not easy targets, the more women who will fight back and harm the person who's trying to harm them, I think the more we will be able to get beyond that stereotype that women are easy victims, that women are targets, as you introduced earlier in the program. And that would be a wonderful goal for us, my generation, to leave for the coming one. And I'd love to see us just change that whole idea that women are easy targets.
I think it would make life better overall.
Oh, for men and women.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thanks again. And we'll catch you next time.
Thank you so much, Alex. I appreciate it.
Gun Rights Radio Network has the best pro Second Amendment, pro gun rights podcast available on the net. The podcasts are absolutely free when subscribing using iTunes or Zoom Marketplace. Or if you want, you can just listen from the website. Make sure you visit gunrightsradio.com to subscribe. Podcasting freedom, one episode at a time.
Welcome back. We greatly appreciate Gayla taking the time to share her insight with us. Now, between her teaching schedule, writing, and time spent with the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network, we were fortunate to have her on. Also, as everyone should know by now, I'm a huge proponent of the Armed Citizens Legal Defense Network. And if you weren't aware, welcome to the show. Gayla's book is called Personal Defense for Women, Practical Advice for Self-Protection, and it just came out in Kindle edition. You can find a link in the show notes. And that will do it for this week. As always, you can follow my daily tips on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. On Twitter, I'm Practical Def, and Facebook is Practical Defense. I also invite you to check out my book on practical home security. It's currently available in DeadTree, Kindle, Nook, and iTunes editions. Autographed copies are available on my website. The URL is alexhaddix.com/book. If you have any tips you'd like to share with everyone, a comment on a show, or if you would like to suggest a topic for an upcoming episode, write into podcast@alexhaddix.com. You can also leave us a voicemail on the new Practical Defense tip and comment line at 805-203-6586. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, stay aware, stay safe.
Hey everybody, we are
Lady Antebellum.
Before every show, we practice. Gotta be prepared.
Exactly. And the American Red Cross wants us to be prepared too. Prepared for disaster. This
world. Just take 3 steps to be Red Cross ready. Create a disaster supplies kit with water, food, and a first aid kit. Make a family communication plan and listen to local radio and TV reports to stay informed.
It's that simple. To learn more, visit redcross.org or contact your local Red Cross chapter today. Thank you so much.
Practical Defense is a member of the Gun Rights Radio Network at gunrightsradio.com. And that does it for this episode. Thank you for downloading and listening to the Practical Defense podcast. For questions, commentary, tips, or topic suggestions, send us an email at podcast@alexhaddix.com. That's podcast@alexhaddix.com. Or leave us a voicemail at 805-203-6586. I look forward to hearing from you.
Music by Kevin MacLeod. You can now hear Gun Rights Radio Network while you're on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phones, or your BlackBerry. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Gun Rights Radio Network shows can be found under Sources.